A wonderful good morning to all of you, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to try and start and see if we have a few more people joining us. I believe there's a few people still outside of the room. But in the interest of not taking away too much time from the panel, I'd love to start us off. So welcome on the second full day of the conference. Very glad to see you here. The focus for today, the topical focus, is disinformation and its impact on peace. So as we all know, disinformation is now cheaper and easier than ever to manufacture. And at the same time, institutional trust is at an all-time low. And what we might think is just garbage information actually poses a real threat to democracy and human rights and peace building. And we'll cover how that happens and how we can fight it as well in just a moment on our first panel of the day. And once the panel wraps up around 10:30, we split up again to join our respective workshops, which will again be running in parallel from 11 to 12:30 and then 1:30 to 5. Lunch will be served in the courtyard, so we still have amazing weather today. Once again, there's also a museum tour, so if you're not joining a workshop, there's a guided tour through the museum, through the exhibition Schleining and Peace, starting at 3 p.m., covering the history and the work of the Austrian Center for Peace. And at 5:30, we have a little highlight for you. We're very pleased to invite you to join us at the screening of How to Build a Truth Engine. That's a 2024 documentary looking at today's topic, looking at disinformation. It's directed by Friedrich Moser, and we're very lucky to have him with us tonight. So he'll be attending the screening, and you'll be able to discuss with him and ask him your questions. So we warmly invite you to join us. After that, at 8, we have the Castle Festival in the Castle Courtyard, where you're also warmly invited. Dinner will be served there. We have a ska and reggae band, Pacheco, who will provide musical accompaniment, so it promises to be a wonderful evening. Quick note on that, we will be joined by external guests at the festival who are covering their own costs. So if you're a participant at the forum, you should have received dinner vouchers for tonight from your workshop hosts. And if you haven't, please ask them and grab the vouchers from them. A few very quick announcements, because if anyone in the audience cannot join us in the afternoon, I might not see you until tomorrow morning, at which point it will be too late. So a few very important organizational pointers. Please do not forget to check out of your hotels tomorrow morning in Stadtschleining before coming here. You can leave your luggage at the hotel, but you won't have time to check out between the end of the conference and the transfers, most likely. So please do that tomorrow morning. And if you're staying in Bad Tatzmannsdorf and Oberwart, please bring your luggage with you to Schleining tomorrow morning, because there won't be a transfer between the end of the conference and the transfer back to Vienna. So if you don't bring your luggage tomorrow morning from Bad Tatzmannsdorf, from Oberwart, you will not have it. It might be easier if you check out of your hotel tonight as well. If you have any questions, as always, grab one of the organizers in case of any doubt. Also very important, there's an online feedback form. I believe we have the QR code ready for you on the slide. So there's an online feedback form. You can scan this QR code. You can also find it in the program, in the workshop rooms. We're very grateful for your feedback, so please do fill that out. And that's everything you need to know in terms of organization. So without further ado, let's dive into the topic, the program for today. Disinformation has, of course, always existed. But unfortunately, it's never been easier than now to produce. And at the same time, we're living through a crisis in trust, where many people no longer feel that they can trust institutions or each other. So to talk about how we can rebuild this trust, I'm very excited to invite my first speakers of the day onto the panel. If I could ask them to join me and for you to give them a preemptive round of applause, and I'll introduce them once we sit. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. So next to me, I have Ambassador Lina Rukšteljene. We practiced. Lina Rukšteljene, who is currently serving as the Ambassador of Lithuania to Austria, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Liechtenstein. Next to Madam Ambassador is Colonel Daniel Hikes-Wurm, who is a Senior Advisor for Defense Policy at the Austrian Federal Ministry of Defense, and he focuses on the security and defense policy implications of technological developments. Then we have Branka Panic, who is the founder of AI for Peace, a San Francisco-based think tank working on researching the benefits, the risks, and the ethical implications of exponential technologies. And her vision is a future in which AI creates lasting peace. We also have with us Dr. Mario Drubic, who heads the Unit for Cooperative Digital Technologies at the Austrian Institute of Technology. And his research examines various aspects of digitalization, focusing mostly on digital sovereignty, resilience, and sustainability. And finally with us, we have Dr. Annika Hansen, who's the Deputy Team Leader of the Policy Partnerships and Innovation Team at the Center for International Peace Operations in Berlin. And she's also a member of the International Advisory Board here at the ACP. Thank you all so much for being with us. So for the purposes of this discussion, I think we can define disinformation as incorrect information that is knowingly and purposely manufactured or disseminated with vested interests. So Mario, let me start with you by asking, is there any research that shows the actual impact? So how many people actually believe disinformation? What impact it currently has on societal trust, on people's behavior?
So, yeah, how many people believe disinformation is always hard to research. But what we can see in the studies is that about 60 to 80% really perceive that they are getting misinformation in their media consumption. And this is across Europe, US, where the studies have mostly been taken out. What we see on the impact side is very interesting, because on the one hand side, you already mentioned it, we have the trust issue. And we've seen this with the misinformation about COVID, for example, about the vaccination, that this also reduces then trust in the health institutions. We've seen this in the political context, that political disinformation results in less trust in state organizations and in democracy. So this is really a big problem, but it also has an influence on the actual behavior of people. So we see this with, in the context of the vaccination, that people are then not taking the vaccination, that this has an impact on the spread of the disease in the population. We've seen it also on the political level with people not going to elections certain parties were then favored due to this misinformation. So it really has a concrete impact on how society works. This manifests itself in many contexts, and that people always overestimate their ability to identify misinformation. So I think this is also very important, that we have a lot of unconsciousness in this context, where people think they are not influenced, but actually they are.
You mentioned people then favoring certain political parties as a result of this disinformation. Branka, is that something that you see in your research as well, that disinformation actually impacts electoral choices?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to say where the causation is. So where we usually see in our research is this correlation, which is still very important. And since we just ended what we call the biggest election year ever, I thought maybe we can reflect on our lessons from last year, 2024, where more than half of the population in the world actually had elections. And I'm just curious now, you're coming from different countries here as well. Which of your countries actually went through elections? Can we see just the hands? And let's hear from everybody now. Do you think the elections were impacted by disinformation? It's like almost like natural now to believe that. And then we are going even step further, and I will concentrate on that part, because although the conversation around disinformation is really a broad one, for us, as I work on artificial intelligence, we are really looking how these emerging tools are actually having a role. I don't want to say, they are, we still think, impacting, although much more evidence is needed in that direction. And just to pick some of the data that I found about this, because if you ask people about this, you will probably hear as many different answers as people you have, including the data coming from this. And it's very hard to say something on a general world level as well. As you said, most of the research is actually coming either from Europe or especially from the United States. It was almost unbelievable to see how much of this research was concentrated on the US, like US was the only country out there. But no, we broadened this research, and what this is actually coming from the organization International Panel on the Information Environment from Switzerland, which did this overall world research on how AI impacted the elections in this big election year. And they concluded that the 80% or that AI has been used in more than 80% of cases. This still does not mean that there were a lot of cases, specific cases mapped, 215 instances of AI, and then continuation in 2025. Some of the countries continued with the elections, of course, this year, and we mapped 9 quite substantial cases of AI use, which we believe impacted the voters as well. Now, I think it's also important to say that not all of these uses are malicious. In fact, across the Global South, which is really interesting, we saw usually Global South is mentioned as sort of a vulnerable area, fragile setting where some of these technologies are being misused and that are even used as a testing grounds for some of the autocratic or misused elements. In fact, a lot of Global South countries use this in a positive and proactive ways where parties and candidates just realized we can use this for a campaign, not for to spread misinformation, disinformation, just to present their candidates in a better view and better note. Now, the final one for me, sorry, this is a really important one because when we ask what the specific impact is, I think last year we got a very tangible example of Romania elections, and I think most of the people here follow this, and I think it will stay in a history as an example of election that was actually annulled and cancelled due to the impact of TikTok and malicious impact of technology and the use of technology. And later on, maybe I can talk more about algorithms and how they are misused in the back end of the entire disinformation campaign.
Let's look at a few specific examples, because you already mentioned Romania, Madam Ambassador. Of course, Lithuania, as a Baltic country, has become one of the primary targets of disinformation, mostly from Russian state actors and very popular narratives in the region. One of them, for example, alleging that states are discriminating, oppressing Russian-speaking minorities so as to sow ethnic division and division among citizens. So maybe you can describe the situation in your country a little bit. Would you say the efforts are successful? Are they making a tangible difference in Lithuanian society?
Thank you, and thank you for inviting to this panel, and good morning to everyone. Of course, we understand that propaganda and disinformation is becoming part of our everyday life. And of course, we understand that those who are initiating certain campaigns are targeting different groups of a society. Minorities might be one of those groups, but in our case, I would say that it's more about social groups, but not about minorities or people representing different background. So social groups, socially vulnerable people, less educated people, nostalgia-led people might be easier targeted than minority groups. For example, the last census data says that in Lithuania we have approximately 85% of Lithuanians who consider themselves Lithuanians, approximately 6% Polish people of Polish origin, 5% of Russians, and less than 1% Ukrainians, Belarusians, Jews, and Tatars. And I've checked while I was preparing for the session the support of different minority groups towards Lithuania's security orientation, towards NATO, towards presence of allied forces in Lithuania. And I was pleasantly surprised that there is no difference among national minority groups or among different groups. there is a difference between educated and less educated people, socially less vulnerable and more vulnerable people. But among national minority groups, such an issue is not, it was not registered. So, but of course, Russia has been using this issue for decades, and even the question that you've raised today shows that they are quite successful, because we are representing us as a country which discriminates minority groups, which is not the truth. National minority groups are, we are allied, we have education in the national minority languages, we have citizenship, we don't have any kind of restrictions in any source of life. Of course, Lithuania is, it's a, we'll have Lithuanian language as a state language, so you have to learn it. But otherwise, I wouldn't say that there is no kind of discrimination. But they are quite successful, and I would say that it's, of course, one of the issues which Russia uses against us and also uses minority groups as is a falsification of history. Presenting history with pseudo-historical facts is something that Russia is trying to do, and they've did the same against Ukraine before the full-scale war had been started, and they tried to do something similar against us.
It's a very important keyword, I think, falsification of history. Very interesting. That's one of the key methods that we see. Maybe if we move to a different part of the world, Daniel, can you share some specific examples of disinformation campaigns that we're seeing in the current conflict between Israel and Iran? Have you looked at that?
Yeah, thank you very much for the questions. Yeah, so not a mic. So the war between Israel and Iran is just another turning point relating to technologically fueled disinformation campaigns. What we see is actually an overwhelming amount of hyper-realistic AI-generated videos floating on the internet, and especially the social networks. So the identification is really difficult, even for experts. So the example I want to bring here is that the video of the bombing of the famous regime prison Evin, it has not yet been possible to actually identify or clarify whether the video is authentic or not, although it's very likely a fake. So what does that mean? So we see that technology has progressed really fast, and for future challenges, that means basically it will result in this kind of shaky understanding of the events. That means it's blurring the lines. So who is the good, who is the bad? And technology is getting faster and faster and even more accessible for almost everyone. So even in the first 10 minutes of a conflict, of an event, there are thousands of videos, messages, and contributions with uncertain origin. So and these, actually, this is the issue. These videos and pictures can then intensify the feelings in an already charged conflict and mobilize people even more. So that means speed is key, and whoever owns the information or whoever is able to shape the information environment pretty fast sets the pace and can also shape the narrative. And whoever owns the narrative can actually gain an advantage in this conflict. So what we call information warfare is about owning this narrative, shaping the information environment. So a recent example, and I do not want to blame the company, but with Palantir, for example, just to illustrate how this really works, because it got famous with the bombing of Natanz most recently. So this should illustrate how complicated this dual-use technology basically is. So, and how reliable we are on this technologically generated, uncertain, and sometimes unreliable information, which can have then real-life outcomes and real-world outcomes. So it's about this software Palantir developed already back a few years, which makes huge amounts of unstructured data from a very wide variety of sources analyzable. So in real time, visually processed, and also linkable. So one could call that a kind of strategic weapon, and it was built actually originally for US counterinsurgency purposes. So, and then the game changer is because it transcends the limits of the classic database queries. So it combines now text documents, images, geodata, communication histories, and much more in an intelligent analysis model. So, and then now it comes to what kind of real life impact it has. So the EIA, so the International Atomic Energy Agency, uses this kind of software since 2015. It relies on this Palantir platform, Mosaic. It's kind of $50 million system, which shifts more than 400 million data points, like satellite imagery, social media, personal logs, in order to predict nuclear threats. So that was the purpose for it. The problem now is, so the software originally designed for war zones and counterterrorism is now presented to a neutral institution like the United Nations body for their intelligence purposes. Mosaic was funded actually by InQtel, so it's back then the CIA's venture arm, and it's always kind of biased, of course. So the algorithms are still a black box, it's unauditable, and it's proprietary. So the core architecture is closed. And Mosaic is now shaping these geopolitical outcomes of recent conflicts, and can still, if you allow me, kind of fuel wars as well, because the outcomes have justified punitive actions. So, for example, sanctions against Iran 2018, but now most recently Israel's Operation Rising Lion from 2025. So like bombing Iran's Natanz nuclear facility. So the question arising from that is, how much do we actually want to rely on those systems? How much control do we need? And how much transparency is required in this whole dual-use environment? So with that, I would just stop here.
I think that's a very important point that Branka also hinted at, right, that we don't always have an insight into how the algorithms, technologies in the background work, on what information they base their conclusions on, but then we have very real-world outcomes that follow from that. Maybe, Annika, if we can look specifically at peace operations that are also quite often targeted by disinformation, maybe you can share with us from your work, from your mission areas, one or two examples of instances that disinformation has affected peace operations.
Yes, sure. I think it's important to note that there are two sides to this, two ways in which disinformation affects sort of peace operations and the context they operate in. So first is the fact that the information space, as we've been talking about, has become such an important factor in the conflict dynamics. And disinformation increasingly it has a destabilizing influence in those conflict dynamics. And on the other side, peace operations are directly targeted. So first, it's important to understand that disinformation doesn't fall out of the sky. It feeds off existing grievances and divisions in society, and it elevates those and twists those for political purposes. So when you said in the beginning that we, rather than discussing disinformation definitions, we consider this fabricated, there's always, it's never black and white. There's degrees of veracity, of truthfulness, and there are degrees of how, with what intent disinformation is distributed. So it's not the sole cause, but it can lead to offline escalations of violence and for peace operations then resulting protection challenges. We've seen that in the DRC, where misreporting and fast spreading or deliberate fast spreading rumors contributed to violence and displacement. We've seen it in contexts like Libya or the Central African Republic, where political opposition is targeted, where minorities are targeted. In Libya, there were some women activists that then eventually, and this veers a little bit into something that's slightly different, which is hate speech, but that had to leave the country because they were systematically targeted. And in the Central African Republic, it was to do with the constitutional reform process where people working on that process were targeted. But also in places like Kosovo, where divisive narratives are intensified through disinformation. Now, disinformation doesn't have to be digital. It can be analog. But as we've heard, the tech really increases the speed with which it spreads, the spread, the complexity, and some people speak about the weaponization of digital communications and social media. So quickly on the second part, when peace operations are directly targeted, it both affects their safety and security very directly, but it also undermines their ability to implement their mandates, particularly where their movements are then restricted. There was a survey among peacekeepers a few years ago where three-quarters of them said they felt threatened and impacted by disinformation. This has gone down a bit in recent years, but that's a lot to do with the withdrawal of MINUSMA. So one of the big theatres in which this was playing out is no longer there with peacekeepers, at least. For peace operations, their legitimacy and credibility is their greatest asset, but also their greatest vulnerability. So that's exactly where disinformation tries to strike. And I think it's important to note that there always needs to be space, and this goes to the veracity question, for legitimate criticism of missions. So a lot of the disinformation in mission areas has to do with the perceived lack of effectiveness of those missions, which it is completely fair to criticize. But where that is then twisted and leads to attacks, then that becomes problematic. Very quickly, so typically, peacekeepers are accused of collaborating either with rebel groups or too much with for instance, in the DRC, MONUSCO is accused of collaborating with Rwanda in supporting the rebels. They're accused of stealing resources and using their trucks and bases as sort of a mafia control hub for illicit trade. In the Central African Republic, the peacekeepers were accused of using UAVs to attack government forces, of selling weapons to rebel groups. And this has led in some cases to staff members having to leave the mission because they were individually identified as people sort of involved that then had to go. I think final point, the goal of this, all of this is of course to discredit the mission, as I said, but it also then weakens the mission's ability to hold conflict parties accountable. So systematically sort of undermining the voice of the mission then also helps others get away with things they shouldn't. Particularly in the DRC, going back to this kernel of truth, there are some very funny comics about MONUSCO and their perceived shortcomings. So I encourage you to have a look at those.
I think the point that you made about degrees of veracity, right, I think that's a very important one because oftentimes something might not be an outright lie. It might just be a slight distortion. Mm-hmm. And your point about humor, I think, is also very important because a lot of the things that are disseminated, especially on the internet, right, humor is a very powerful means of conviction. Mm-hmm. For people. And this brings me to you, Mario, and I think maybe we can sort of steer the discussion towards possible solutions here. So we've heard so much about how all of this happens on tech tools, right? We've heard about TikTok, where the algorithm behind it is obscure. We've heard about Palantir software. I'm also thinking about places like Telegram, for example, where, you know, anyone can disseminate anything and there's no checks. So how much can we force tech companies, do you think, to take some responsibility here beyond their own goodwill? Is that something that you see could be part of the solution?
Yeah, So we have to look at two different levels here. Yeah, on the one hand side, we have basically the open media discussion, like in the social media channels and so on. There was the tendency to promote this self-control. Yeah, that we had teams in the respective companies to monitor. Now we had the backlash with the developments in the US. That these teams have been basically reduced or removed, that this is not happening at the core where the information is spread. So the question then is, when we have this international connections here, yeah, and we have also states' interests involved, yeah, how can we enforce technological measurements or organizational measurements with these companies? And I think this is difficult, and there the legislative approach would be to make these companies responsible for what information they spread, and the European Union is moving towards this direction. The other level is when we talk about this closed channel communications. Yeah, you mentioned Telegram and so on, and I think there it is much more difficult. Yeah, because there we also have this constant balance between privacy of communication and monitoring the content, yeah, and taking care of people communicating. So this is, I think, a very delicate point. And in Austria, we just had the discussion about the Trojan horse to be installed on mobile phones, and there was an intensive discussion then, how can we restrict this so that it is only used for the purpose it is intended for? Yeah, and this would be one approach, because then you're working on the end device and not dependent on where the information comes from or where the server is located. So there are possibilities, but we always have this privacy discussion, yeah, and we have to take care not to overstep then in the reaction and have a backlash then in terms of privacy the right for private conversation here. So I think this is also a very political discussion we have to make.
Let's stick with solutions on the state, the institutional level. Madam Ambassador, I know that Lithuania is heavily investing also in defense. How much of this focuses on hybrid defense, on defense against disinformation attacks and on countering that?
Yes, you mentioned very rightly that we're investing heavily into our defense. We now dedicate approximately 4% of our budget for the defense needs, and it's going to increase next year up to 5 or 6%. So we really invest, and of course we understand that we have to be prepared for all different kind of attacks. So nowadays we see that everything could be weaponized, migration, information, whatever. And also we see that from misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, our neighbor Russia is moving to kinetic operations, also attacking, physically attacking opponents living in Lithuania, sabotage property, damage infrastructure. We all read in the news, in papers, that underwater cables been damaged in Baltic Sea one by one, I don't know, 3 or 4 times in a row. So we see that it's not only disinformation, it's also some other attempts already made. But coming back to disinformation, we see that it's also important to involve the whole society, because it's a whole society is affected, not only institutions, not only militaries. And the whole society should be as resilient as possible. And therefore, we involve, of course, institutions, but also media, NGOs, academia, into the increase the media literacy, critical thinking of population. And also, we have established some kind of cross-institutional working group among different institutions in Lithuania in order to detect and to counteract disinformation and information campaigns carried out by our neighbor. And we see that we see increase of disinformation campaigns while we are organizing some kind of very important events. NATO summit was held in Vilnius, so before NATO summit, we've seen huge increase in the different campaigns. We also disconnected from all Soviet-style electricity grid from with Russia. So while being carrying out the last steps in disconnecting from the electricity grid, we also seen increase in the disinformation campaign. So in general, this cross-institutional group was very effective countering disinformation, such a difficult or maybe more important events.
So that sounds like a very holistic approach on many different levels. Daniel, do you feel that in military institutions currently, are we seeing strategic enough response? What would a strategic response by military actors look like to prepare to counter disinformation?
Yeah, that's a very tough and difficult question, you know, because it's always about asking what role should military play in this whole information domain at all. And so yes, we are preparing for that. We are increasing our investments in capabilities and capacities such as strategic communication and so on. So we are training our soldiers, our employees on that. So what is this information? How can you actually recognize it? What to do about it? From an institutional perspective, we're also looking into technical measures. Of course, so we are running several projects, also one, for example, with AID, of course, and other institutions. And on a European level, we have several entities dealing with that. But as was discussed before, so that's not a pure military issue. So that's a whole of society, whole of government topic, which needs to be addressed properly. So in order to avoid kind of securitization of this whole domain, and it was mentioned before, so the weaponization of social media, it's a risk because there are some technological developments which make this even more difficult. So now with AI getting more and more important in our everyday life, we have the ability to basically micro-target people. So kind of individual approach, so from several actors, which makes this whole environment even more difficult to tackle. So, and the question of what role should military play needs to go hand in hand with what role should the society, what role should the state play in that. So when it comes to dealing with tech companies, for example, there are several attempts, of course, of the European Union, it was mentioned, like the Digital Services Act, for example. But nevertheless, so that's one side of the coin. The other one, it's about regulations. So it's about this kind of overarching umbrella. But the other one is operationalize those regulations in terms of how can we actually enable organizations, institutions, individuals to recognize, to deal with that. Otherwise, it's simply just an umbrella without the content behind. So this is something we are still lacking, I would say. So when it comes to digital skills, there are lots of Eurobarometer surveys and so on, also the 2030 objective of the European Union, so that almost 100% of the population should have appropriate digital skills. So currently, there's still a gap. So and that's always this run for this asymmetric issue. So which then is also a problem for the military, not only in our home countries but also being deployed. So that means what I mean with this asymmetric approach is, so there are regulations, there are certain skills, but there's an adversary, an opponent, which wants to undermine certain, for example, democratic values and such, and they will always target on that. That's what hybrid warfare is about. So they are trying to identify our vulnerabilities and immediately hit those, because our legislation is slow. Lots of discussions are going on. What should be regulated? How to regulate? And that's then the time the adversary actually hits our targets. So it's about regulation and education together.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question here, maybe to Branka, because AI has come up multiple times on this panel, right? And we've heard that, of course, it's sped up the speed at which you can produce anything you like, really. But in my work as a journalist, a lot of the content that is misleading that I encounter isn't actually AI generated. Oftentimes it's not even really trying very hard. So for example, people posting footage from one conflict and, you know, saying it's from another, or even people posting footage from video games, you know, saying that it's from a real conflict zone, or this very famous case recently where Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, pockets a tissue and Russia disseminated that it was a bag of cocaine. So very actually kind of, you know, not that cleverly done. So do you think that the exacerbating impact of AI is going to be really the higher quality, or do you think it's simply about the speed at which you can create and disseminate misleading material?
Yeah, that's a great question, and maybe gives us a chance to pick up on a couple of points and for me to maybe comment on some of the things that were mentioned before. First, I think that's absolutely true. It's speed, but also scale in which we are spreading the information. And maybe to go back to what Annika mentioned, which I completely agree that disinformation, misinformation, hate speech, we work a lot in the field of hate speech, as such, is not a new phenomenon. So the video of Macron basically was just a real video used to spread misinformation, disinformation, which we are dealing with since we started using communication, right? And I really insist on mentioning this because I work in conflict zones. Now we are marking the anniversary of two genocides, actually, one in Rwanda, one in Bosnia, where hate speech, disinformation was really used in a pre-digital age and created such crucial consequences. So as such, it's a really important phenomenon to pay attention to. But I really think it's truly important to understand these new developments in technological fields. And now we are entering a third wave of these developments. Now we talked about AI and speed and scale and how now these tools are much more available to people as well. Like when we started working on this 10 years ago, only very well resourced institutions were actually able to do this. It was not easy to create a fake video, which is trustworthy, so to say, really believable. Today, any student, anybody, like any of you can just download a program and create a fake video. I don't think this will be an issue. I think what will be really important to understand is this micro-targeting that you mentioned, this new wave of technology that is allowing us to understand what is happening on the back end, not only the content we are creating, but how we are targeting you and you and you and you in a different way. So 10 years ago, you were all receiving one simple content. Let's say this was a huge investigative journalism project around Brexit, how this information has been used to mislead the populations around the migration and threat of migrants. And all of the people that were targeted with the same content. With generative AI and with the algorithms helping us understand each one of us individually, we will all be targets in a completely different way. So this is one thing that I think it's important to understand, the new world of AI agents we are entering, agentic AI, and how this technology is learning about us much more intensively than before. But I also think, and you both mentioned this, we have a lot of lessons that we are forgetting. We really need to go back and to remember what happened during, who remembers Cambridge Analytica here? The please, all of you who did not raise the hand, go and remind ourselves what happened during this time, because it's a blueprint of what is happening now with an additional tools. And I will just briefly explain how the company scrapped the data in an illegal way. This is one of the, I think, motivating signals afterwards that we did learn something and introduce some regulation for Facebook to actually ban this type of scrapping of third parties, the third party that then sold this data to target the voters and to do many other things to nudge people to vote in a certain direction. And this happened. This is almost 7, 8, 9 years ago. We have a lesson that is out there with algorithms specifically used with simple things. Like, I really like your example about Macron, because sometimes it can be a really simple content, not even perceived as a disinformation and fake, which is just used for algorithms to be spread in a certain direction. During Cambridge Analytica, Facebook used this little trick inviting people to vote, where for certain voters, they realize that they will go to vote just if they see the photo of their friends who already voted. You know, you had that click on Facebook, I already voted, right? I went there. And then you feel a little bit of nudge from your friend. It doesn't even, you don't even have to change your voting preference, right? It's just important to bring the votes up. So just for all of us to understand that, yes, we have a lot of lessons, and I think it's really important for additional reason for this multi, how did you say, all of society approach, which is also important, but I'm a bit afraid that we are, if we are putting emphasis on, if we say that uneducated people are more prone to disinformation, that we are putting emphasis on them as a sort of an accountable party. And I really think that big tech platforms, as you mentioned, have kind of a bigger role in this and much bigger power. And I would say, why not mentioning Palantir, right? I mean, why not calling on these companies and agencies and saying what are the things that they can actually do to make their systems more transparent so that we as researchers can raise our voices and say, look, this is happening. We are losing control of our trust of our information ecosystem, of our democracies, even beyond democracies. Like, we are really losing the trust in our system, which I think is a much bigger problem than any algorithm or AI being misused out there.
I think your point about micro-targeting is so important because it ties into something that Annika said at the beginning, right, which is it amplifies grievances that are already there. And of course, if you can amplify my grievances, your grievances specifically, rather than, you know, general grievances, then that's going to be all the more effective. I want to give you the chance to ask some questions as well in a little while. But first, I'd like to maybe zoom in on the solutions a little bit more and ask all of you, maybe starting with you, Annika, are you seeing any best practice projects? So any initiatives to counter disinformation, any approaches that you're seeing really work, really make a difference? Is there anything you can share with us?
Sure. I think missions, because they've been confronted with this for a while in different ways, have really come up with a whole of mission approach, to echo your term. But I wanted to just make one remark going back, which is because I've spoke about peace operations, but really this affects everything the international community does in the security, humanitarian, and development field. And so when we talk about maybe like the interaction with big tech, one of the things the UN is learning is how to be better at speaking with one voice when they engage with the tech companies, because you had maybe UNHCR talking to tech about the data question. You had, you know, the Department of Peace Operations talking about content moderation. But really to try and use the huge leverage really that the UN has when they do speak with one voice, to have some sort of engagement or a better engagement, more constructive engagement with the tech companies. As we've heard, there's quite a few actors involved, and for peace operations, it's really critical to understand incentives, goals, processes, channels, target groups. And also, I think you mentioned the NATO summit, windows of risk, where is an election coming, or when do we really need to be aware that disinformation might be stronger. And the so the UN peace operations have done a lot in terms of really working on strengthening their situational awareness, and particularly on the analog side, they have ways of monitoring radio and narratives, not just to spot disinformation, but really understand what the narratives are, so that when they can see, so they understand the information environment more generally, as well as technical tools to do social media analysis. And then, of course, you mentioned strategic communications, also a major push in UN operations to try and do that better. One of the more innovative approaches is really because, as we've heard, it's like in the US, they have this game whack-a-mole, right? You know, so something pops up and you try and react, you try and debunk. I think everybody has sort of given up on that. And instead, it really is about, even in the context of peace operations, trying to build resilience, trying to work with civil society organizations, strengthen media literacy, work with bloggers, and so on. It's still sort of, given the wave of disinformation, it's still sort of here and there, but there are some good examples, I think, that we can learn from. And then partnerships, working and learning from each other, I think, is something that the UN also tries to do. And maybe because I've spoken a lot about the UN, it's interesting to note that there is an EU mission in Moldova which has a specific mandate. It's the first mission that has a mandate to work with the government to strengthen cyber resilience and strengthen the society in the face of attacks. This leads me to my last point, because I think what's particularly difficult in terms of response for peace operations is when either the host government is complicit in because, of course, they are dependent on the consent and the collaboration with the host government, and a feature of conflicts today, which is an increasing internationalization of conflict environments where third-party actors spread misinformation, like in Libya, mobilizing support for General Haftar. In Qatar, Russia was driving accusations against MINUSCA, the same in Mali, which makes it very difficult for missions to fulfill their political role, to find political solutions. So just, I think that's one part that we, you know, the people that the when that makes it really difficult. We've spoken a lot about the tools and the effect and so on, but what is behind it? And maybe one last thought on the what is different now, and what AI also I think enables, is to have a much more strategic approach to disinformation as a strategic political tool, not just sort of in the context of the DRC where you're trying to stoke up violence or undermine the mission, but really at a major strategic level.
I think that's very interesting, especially what you said about windows of risk. So, Ambassador, I'd like to invite you to share some solutions that you've seen work. But I would also like to ask an additional question, which is, we know that, for example, you said the NATO summit, right? We know there are these windows of risk, but at the same time, we know that we have waning institutional trust. So how do we include the public? Do we ask the media to tell the public, listen, be more aware? There's a heightened window of risk right now, knowing full well that many people in the public no longer trust the media. So how do we include civil society from an institutional side when, you know, trust in institutions is waning?
Well, probably in Lithuania, situation is a bit different than in many other countries, because we know in which environment we live. So in general, the whole society, media, NGOs, institutions, we know that we have one enemy. And media should not be explained that we should be aware and we should be reacting properly. So as I've said, there is an inter-institutional but also a whole society approach towards countering disinformation. And as you've said, also for some important events, it's very important not to leave a space empty. So in general, it means that the institutions should communicate intensively, transparently, comprehensively on all developments. So if you fill the space with trusted and reliable information, so in general, you do not leave a space for disinformation. Of course, everything might happen, and in social networks, it could be spread, but still, there would be always possibility to check with reliable sources and to see where is the truth. I would like to also mention some Lithuanian initiatives which might be of interest to others. For example, in Lithuania, because I've said it's a whole society approach, so it means that you always try to involve as broad social groups as possible. So we start with children, And we have in Lithuania already for several years national disinformation literacy exam for senior school children. So in general, thousands of Lithuanian school children are taking part voluntarily, of course, in the national disinformation literacy exam. It's, of course, with some prices, and so it's kind of attractive for children. But at the same time, it's also, you know, spreads the information among different groups, and through children, it goes to the families. Another initiative, which is already 10, 11 years old, is called Lithuanian Elves. Why elves? It's because elves are fighting with trolls. So Lithuanian elves are thousands of Lithuanians who are taking part in social media chats and spreading the true information in chats, just informing people, spreading different opinion, and presenting the Lithuanian view on some major developments. So it's, of course, it's voluntary, and I cannot say how many people taking part, but it's already thousands. So it's already like 10 years ago started, so you can see that it's a not new phenomenon. We're already fighting disinformation for more than a decade, for sure.
But I think it also shows, doesn't it? I mean, I love the concept of elves, but somebody needed to come up with that. Yeah. Somebody needed, that's a communicative effort, that's a creative effort that you need to invest resources in, right? It's not going to happen by itself. So I think that's a great example. Daniel, did you bring any initiatives, any examples that you can share?
Maybe two. So the first from the European Union. So the EU introduced a whole set of measures and legislative acts to regain this lost trust and also build resilience. So the first one I already mentioned, it was the Digital Service Act. One of the two main goals is to create this safer digital space in which the fundamental rights are actually protected, so for all users of digital services. And this enshrined code of conduct on disinformation actually aims to combat disinformation risks, fully upholding the freedom of speech, for example, and also enhancing transparency. Another one, which is addressing the media landscape, also from the European Union, is the Media Freedom Act, which also supports quality media, which is a factor for building resilience, I would say. And then one, that's the second one, from an institutional perspective, it's the so-called Hybrid Center of Excellence, which encompasses both, so the civil and the military parts to this whole hybrid issues. So it's this Helsinki-based institution. It's an international autonomous network, and so it's open for all EU and NATO members, and it has some associated countries as well. So this is really addressing this whole, not only information environment, but the wider range of hybrid issues from a very comprehensive perspective. Yes.
So we had some educational approaches, some legislative approaches, some institutional approaches. We're really seeing it's a comprehensive effort. Blanca, maybe you want to chime in from a tech perspective. Mm-hmm. So we've heard a lot of things about how, you know, modern technologies can pose a challenge to the information environment. Maybe you can share some ways in which they can actually help counter disinformation.
Yeah, I love this order as well, because I think it's crucial to have them all. And then technology has been usually seen as this misused factor in the entire conversation. And I have to say it has been extremely hard. Sometimes I lose hope with training the technologies. So we've been using the same thing to catch some of these instances of at least artificially created contents, right? Because it's really, truly hard for humans to catch up on what is happening in the digital spaces. And I kind of had a feeling that we are doing a favor to malicious actors as well, because as soon as we publish something, how can you actually figure out that a certain content is artificially generated? They pick up on that. So they're extremely fast, they advance their systems, and now this is not a relevant factor anymore. So this is a sort of a continuous work and catching and tracking and training the systems. But I still think it's a motivational one. So all of these examples that I talked about as a negative examples is still not some AI running around and doing things on their own, right? It's somebody making a conscious decision to use the algorithm or AI in a certain way. And this is what we are doing in our work, just to plug in some of the examples of training the algorithms, making that conscious decision to actually use them in another way, in a positive way, in more sustaining peace, rather than creating, spreading disinformation, and in our cases, creating conflict. As Annika was mentioning, some of these examples go way beyond the disinformation campaigns and are actually hate speech campaigns and lead to violence, to even mass atrocities, and as I said, genocides. So we work with young people, not necessarily young people, civil society organizations across conflict zones who traditionally worked in the space of catching the instances of hate speech, then organizing some of the peace-building activities, dialogues, facilitating conversations beyond communities, who were really struggling now to catch up, to keep up with all of the speed and scale we talked about spreading this content. So we train them, we connect them with data scientists, and we make them build these tools together and build the tools that can help them to automatically track what is happening in online spaces. And then to react also in a virtual space. I like this example from your country as well. How we can also use the tools for this, not necessarily for spreading the hate speech or disinformation, but spreading the peace speech as well. Mm-hmm. And also understanding, now we know a lot what constitutes hate speech online. We don't know a lot what is, or enough, what constitutes peace speech online and what has can have impacts, positive impacts in conflict areas. So this is an area that I'm very passionate about and hopeful that in combination with humans and machines, we can create something positive for our societies.
So just retraining the machines. Annika, I believe you want to add to that.
Yeah, just a point that's sort of implicit in what Branka was saying, but just, I don't want to give the impression that the UN comes in and then builds these capacities. In all of these countries, there are really active civil society organizations that are themselves working on disinformation, misinformation, whether it's in Mali or elsewhere. So just to underline that point, I mean, the reason that you can do that is because there are local organizations that are already doing this work that you can support. Mm. I just wanted to make clear it's not sort of us coming in and creating something. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, from everything that everyone has said on this panel, it's very clear that it has to be a bottom up effort that involves everyone, because otherwise it's simply not going to reach the people that it needs to reach. Yeah. Mario, would you like to share some examples of what you've seen work?
Yes, so I liked very much what you said at the end. This, we need this combination, yeah, of tools and people. Okay. And I think education is the foundation, yeah, so making transparent how things work. Because as I said initially, this erosion of trust, yeah, is something that then also reduces the trust in the campaigns, yeah, in the institutions, and that's, I think, critical, because then it's too late to reach people with all the tools and campaigns you are providing. So what we are trying to do is to support this transparency in some way by providing fact-checking platforms, for example. We are collaborating with ETMO, the European Media Observatory, and GATMO, the German-Austrian Media Observatory, so to provide them with tools that at least the media people can quickly check information, videos, images, texts, for their credibility, yeah, for their trustworthiness, and to give them also the context, yeah, of why this is not trustworthy, yeah, what it has been put in the wrong context, it has been manipulated whatsoever. But there we are, of course, facing the problem of this individual content that was mentioned before, and the speed with what this is happening now. Yeah, so this is really, as you said, yeah, we are currently always trying to catch up, yeah, with those creating this content. And the other thing is that we have this strategic approach to disinformation, yeah, where they're creating narratives, yeah, which is then not just the message itself, yeah, the message might be valid to some point. Yeah, you cannot discuss about that. But the whole storyline behind, yeah, the context, the narrative, that is what is problematic. And what we are doing in that respect is at least to find the groups then, yeah, when this these groups are building up, yeah, and they are moving away from the open platforms, yeah, and getting in more closed circles, to provide tools then also for the law enforcement agencies to look into what is happening there, yeah, and to give them an overview, because there are so many of these channels, yeah, popping up every day, and the agencies then need tools to identify where is hate speech going on. And this is not just the text, and there might be symbols that are used, yeah, or what kind of narrative are they telling there, yeah? And there we have tools to visualize that, yeah, so that they can then target their interventions on those groups that are really going problematic before they disappear somehow on closed channels where even the law enforcement agencies don't have access to.
Yeah, so using technology to bring a little bit of build tools that bring a little bit of clarity into this chaotic information space, yeah, as it can sometimes be. Yeah, thank you so much. I'd like to get a sense of how many questions, comments there are from the audience. So we have 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, a lot. So so let's get started, I guess. Mr. Ambassador at the back, if we can have a microphone.
You get a microphone.
Thank you for the discussion, quality of the discussion. And it was very informative. I'm somewhat inspired to make a small complementary point on the experience of special monitoring mission in Ukraine from 2014 till 2019. What is critical is monitoring. Facts matters, and how to establish the facts was critically important for us. And it was 487 kilometers long, ceasefire line, a security zone. And the verification is critically important. Accountability for Annika made very pertinent cases. That's the reason why I took the floor to speak about the SMM case. And this institution, Austria, is very much, you know, we took technical training also from the Austrian Ministry of Defense at that time, also with also diplomats here. Ambassador Christian Sora and other ambassadors contributed to the work. But I'm trying to say, for future peace operations, I'm not an expert on disinformation or artificial intelligence, but how to establish the fact. Verification is critically important. Accountability, a joint accountability mechanism, is very important. This time, it was only 400 kilometers, maybe longer ceasefire lines and security zones. In our case, we built the team incrementally. We were, at the beginning, just a mission for political monitoring. But then we somehow transformed into a operational monitoring. We start to use technology, UAVs, some electronic cameras, also some satellites and others, and we took what was Alfinch, I will not take further time. We were producing every day a daily report. Daily report was very critical because the local teams were sending the data, we were compiling it. What we have learned, data processing is also critically important. Data processing. We established at the end with the colleagues a fusion center with technology, but how to manage with the data, how to evaluate it. I'm not an expert on technology, but for future peace operations, my humble opinion, still human patrols is the essential thing. Mm. Technology is a force multiplier, but a complementarity one. Facts will matter in the future also. Thank you.
Thank you so much for those additional comments. And I think it ties in with what Branka and Mario were saying about you know, using tech also for good. I think satellite imagery is a prime example of how you can you know, use it for verification purposes as well. We had...
May I add?
Of course.
Because it's a very interesting question. And please allow me, as a military person, it's always difficult to talk about such things. But yes, facts matter. But I want to open a new track on this now. So talking about the cognitive warfare issue. So actually raising the question, what fuels or constitutes then a kind of cognitive behavior? So the mental decision-making processes. We are talking a lot of about cognitive biases and such things. So therefore, whoever is maybe faster with something and triggers some emotions, feelings, and so on, can actually impact that, while getting the facts right later on might not have the same impact. So from an institutional or state perspective, yes, that's true, but it's critical to actually link those two things. Otherwise, we will lose this kind of war about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mean linking the sort of human cognitive bias aspect to the facts on the ground?
Yes.
Thank you. We have one question here, another question at the back, and a third question here. Thank you. Mario, yeah.
Yes, so starting with the second question, I think that this is actually what we are working on, yeah, to use AI to detect this, yeah, and because you need to understand the technology and then you can also use the technology, but it's always catching up also, of course, with those creating this content. The first question...
It was not a question.
It was the issue of the fact that, you know, the content that we see on platforms is highly dependent on the platform itself.
I wanted to comment on that as well, because that brings me to this digital sovereignty, yeah, and understanding the algorithms and having transparent algorithms. You mentioned this with Palantir before, but I think this also applies, of course, for these algorithms that decide which content we are seeing, yeah? And if we are relying on algorithms where we as Europeans don't have access to and don't understand how they work, I think this is one of the core problems that we are currently facing as a European society.
Mm. Annika?
Yeah, maybe just a small comment. I think this of course, we have several conflict areas, whether it's Gaza or Sudan, where it's almost impossible to have actual physical reporters on the ground, which then makes it those areas where truth is very contested, and it's difficult to do what you're saying, proactively fill a space with truth and have reliable, good reporting. And that makes it all the more reliant on technology and just enhances the problem where really we are most dependent on really getting some good, reliable information. So there's a tension there, and the work that you do is really important.
Mm. Thank you. The lady in the black shirt had a question as well.
Hi. Thank you. It was really, really insightful. I noticed that more and more apps are getting out there that depend on AI. And some of those apps really, really are directed to vulnerable groups. Like a friend of mine is developing an app that helps connect psychologists with patients, but some forms are already created with AI. I personally try to plan something educational. It's also a vulnerable group. What kind of measurements in security have to be set in place to protect those groups? I mean, it's used sometimes really carelessly at this point to inject that knowledge that is created actually by humans and that could influence a well-meant product in reality. Is there something to take measurements?
Thank you. Franca, maybe you want to take that as the...
Yeah, I think that's a great question and important beyond the... especially for vulnerable groups. I can make a parallel with our work when we work in fragile and conflict settings. This is what we also understand as additional fragility, right? Using any of these tools can create unintended harms. In this case, I mean, in any case, to be honest, when we are developing the digital tools, for me, the minimum would be those ethical standards that we've been working, like this space has been growing for a decade now, trying to make a point that these cases are really important. And the very first point for me would be don't allow technologies only developing these tools, where you see often this as recognition of opportunity of creating something in a vulnerable space, offering a service to a vulnerable population without knowing anything about that field of work. And I can share an example of my friend as a good example, who is actually a doctor working on sleep studies, who is developing such an app to help to understanding that he will never be able to reach all of the people in his in hospital where he's working on clinical studies, and he wants to try to use technology to reach out to broader groups of people to train the system with his own data, right? He's not scrapping something from the internet. He's putting 20 years of his career in this, which I would say is a good starting place. With that layer of, we need to make sure that all of the people with field experience, which such type of topic experience or even lived experience, understand the nuances of technologies and all of the additional risks that are coming with this. And this is what we have been seeing in our work a lot as well, where people who are building the tools are kind of leaving this to field experts. Like, you are experts in do no harm. You are experts in conflict sensitivity. You will know how to deal with this without having any knowledge on algorithms and how the algorithmic systems are functioning. People will not be able to embed do no harm. So this would be the very first basic. We call it ethics by design. Don't wait for these products to come to surface. While you start designing them, put all of these guardrails and systems and principles embedded in the design of the system.
Yeah. I think Mario and Annika both have a comment to add.
I just have a very, very small addition to what you're saying. Think about the life cycle of the data, right? There's so much focus on collecting the data and then maybe even on storing the data, but there's not so much emphasis on when should we delete this data, right? That, like, everybody's sort of gathering data. So I just you need a plan for the entire life cycle of the data that you're collecting and using. That was just to add to all the things that you have said. Yeah.
There is an entire movement of data minimization as well, understanding that because this was a trend, this is where the money was coming. The more data you have, right, the better your position to actually earn something out of it. And now I think we did quite a bit of work and good work in emphasizing that this data minimization is important. But just the last one from my side, like I really think it's important with these kind of fragile cases, especially when we are dealing with health and mental health, really understand the risks. I mean, not all of the things need to, and I'm a huge believer in digital tools, but not everything has to be digital. Like, really make sure that you are not harming people that you are trying to help. Yeah. So think twice before you build the app. I mean, whoever, not you. I mean, me as well. I'm building apps, so, yeah.
I think health is a very good example, yeah, because it needs a lot of trust. Yeah. On the other hand, the people are very desperate. Yeah, because when we look at the public health system, yeah, they are eroding. Yeah, it's very hard to get a good consultation. But on the other hand, we have established trust mechanisms like certification as a health product. We started with software 15 years ago working on that, but this is a very high bar to jump over, yeah? And especially in the app content, this doesn't work anymore, yeah? So what we currently see is that we have a big gap between these millions of apps that are coming out, yeah, out of nowhere with no background, and those that are certified as a medical product. So we need to find graduated trust in between, where we say, okay, we have ethics by design, for example, or similar mechanisms. It is based on valid data, but it's not yet a medical product. Yeah, so this trust establishment and making this transparent, yeah, I think health is a very good example that we need new approaches to move forward here and cannot stay on the old mechanisms that we established 50 years ago.
Thank you so much.
Maybe just one last recommendation. Maybe you want to visit the AI Act, the Artificial Intelligence Act of the European Union, which is a very comprehensive product and which also entails lots of those things we have just talked about. And maybe the NIS2 directive as well from a cybersecurity perspective.
We had one final question. I think we have time for one more from the gentleman in the front here.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. And thank you to the organizers for inviting us. I am Mohamed Aboubakar Diko, and I come from West Africa, Mali. I am a researcher. So I come from Mali, but there we have two problems. The first problem is about the analphabetism. We have many population that never went to school. And the second problem is about the network. We have many areas without networking connection, without connection. So the only way to be informed is the traditional media. And this is why my question is about the economic model of this media. Given that this media, as we heard about it, contribute to misinformation and disinformation, and that this media position are often dictated by their founders, the one who give money. So the question is, how can we reconcile the need for independent media committed to peace with the necessity of a lawful and a sustainable economic model? This is my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Annika, do you have...
Sure, I can start, and I'm sure others will jump in. First, just recognizing... recognizing that both in Mali and in DRC, the UN placed a lot of emphasis on their radio communication rather than sort of digital communication. And I think, like on some of these big policy initiatives, the UN Secretary General's roadmap on digital cooperation, and in the Global Digital Compact that was part of the pact, there's all these calls for and demands for more connectivity, connecting the whole world, that as an important factor in development and so on. But we're still a long way, clearly, from making that happen. I think it's been recognized, but there's still a lot of steps to go in order to do that. But in Mali also, the mission worked with traditional media, with journalists, but also with bloggers and so on, in order to try and strengthen. But it's always, you work with individuals, and I should also say, some have cautioned against that, because if those journalists then are critical of the government, of course you then sort of put a target on their back. So you have to be, it's a challenging, but I think it's important, because you need the capacities locally.
Thank you so much.
Can I maybe connect on this? And I think you raised so many important points, not only in your question, in your introduction as well. And first, this one, which I'm really glad we are not leaving the room without understanding, that 2.6 billion people in the world still don't have an access to internet. And this is what Annika is mentioning. There is a huge effort at the UN to recognize this and to really work on this gap. We worked on electricity gap, digital gap, internet gap. Now we talk about AI gap, and will this actually create the situation? Mm-hmm. We are quite, I mean, at least in my organization, we are quite optimistic, but also in moments pessimistic when we see these kind of numbers. Now, this is at the same time making our work much more accurate and better, and this is this part of demystifying AI that I would like us all to understand, because so much of the work that goes inside of the data, even data collection, comes from people on the ground. In this kind of context, we count on local monitors. In some cases, the technology is already on that level to automatically scrap the information from media or from online resources. But you can imagine, in your country and mine, you cannot trust all of the resources out there. So we work with trusted people who are on the ground and who understand, who are listening, who listen their communities, understand what is happening, and helping us to actually take that as a data point in our systems, for example, when we work on conflict prediction. Now, you raised the question on economic model, and I'm not sure if you think about economic model of journalism or social media platforms, because I think it's maybe related as well, but I still think journalism has a certain dose of, at least some media or many in some cases, this dose of journalistic responsibility as well, putting their economic model. Even I think New York Times basically gets the money from their quizzes or things like that, really making sure, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure that their journalism can stay independent from the resources that are coming. They don't charge things and so on, and they can keep the independence of their journalists really intact. With social media, we can talk for days about this, because I really think they're putting profit before people, and that's a big problem. And that's why all of these systems are not transparent and making our lives much more complicated in Mali and Mexico and many other countries. And as long as this is very personal opinion, as long as we don't change that model, it will be really hard to work on changing how these platforms are functioning, with a huge emphasis on, I'm speaking as a Global South voice, we were really looking what has been happening in the EU with the EU AI Act, before that with the GDPR as well, but especially with the EU AI Act. And I have to say, we are a bit worried now with what we are hearing, like how some of the things are backsliding on the application side, because this was our hope. Like, this can be done through regulation, and regulation is a cure. But if it's not, then I don't know what is.
Thank you so much. I'm really sorry. I'm afraid we're out of time. But I'm sure the speakers are going to be around during the coffee break and after, so you can grab them and share your thoughts with them. Yeah, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. I believe our speakers deserve a huge round of applause. Please stay in the room for another minute because I do have an announcement. So before you make your way to your workshops, I just want to announce a raffle and the opportunity to win, as a first prize, two wonderful books written by Branka Panic, AI for Peace, and then written by Nathan Coyle, Open Data for Everyone. So that would be the main prize. And as a runner-up prize, we have three beautiful pieces of art that you can see here on the set on the stage. They're these beautiful reinterpretations of the Crane, the Austrian Center for Peace Crane, redesigned by Nathan Coyle as well. So the way to participate is to draw a ticket as you leave the room. There's somebody waiting outside. You can draw a ticket, and the winners will be announced during the closing session tomorrow. So who knows? Maybe you're the lucky one. Make sure to grab a number. And please, I hope you have productive workshops. Please enjoy them. See you back here at 5:30 for the movie screening. Thank you.